Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Writer Michael Perry has fans both around these parts and far from his home state of Wisconsin. His past books have told the story of his time as an EMT around the small town of New Auburn, Wisconsin. We've learned about his adventures in raising chickens and two daughters, and his friendship with a unique cannon-building neighbor in western Wisconsin. Michael Perry's latest book is a collection of essays, some of which are reminiscent of his work in those earlier books, and all of which are cause to pause and reflect on life in the upper Midwest. The book, called From the Top, was culled from short monologues he included on the syndicated radio show he hosts from the Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield and from his regular column in the Wisconsin State Journal. Michael Perry joins us in the studio this morning to catch up on things. Always nice to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
The book that is just out is a collection of essays, thematically diverse ones. And I wanted to start by asking you, you know, you're often a longer form writer than a 2 or 3 page essayist. Obviously, your radio monologues aren't designed to be 10-minute reads. But do you find it, is it liberating or terrifying to try to say something in 800 or 1,000 words?
Well, I wouldn't say it's terrifying because I'm not quite that dramatic, but it's been very challenging because you're right. Most of the stuff I write, I mean, my books are anywhere between 75,000 to 125,000 words. Magazine pieces I do are usually 6,000 to 10,000 words, and even most of my essays are knocking on that territory. Whereas here, these are monologues taken from a weekly radio show that I do, 10 Show Radio, and there's 600 to 800 words, and you have to find some way to put a ribbon on it in 600 or 800 words. So it has been a challenge. It's been one of those nice challenges. It's fun. I say sometimes if you're going to play tennis, you got to put up a net. And here you just have this space, and it's not about your ego or anything like that. It's just a fundamental element of doing a show of that nature. You only have so much time.
Well, I would think the nice thing is it's a lot easier to throw out a 600 or an 800 word essay and start over than to say, oh my God, I've gotten 5,000 words into this and I hate it.
Well, yeah, although that part's interesting because the other thing it's taught me, I'm an obsessive revisionist and I just love to sit with a line over and over sometimes for a day. And my books are very dense and very polished. And when you're writing a weekly, whether it's a newspaper column, which I do that too, you know, I do a newspaper column for the Wisconsin State Journal, and I do these weekly radio monologues, you do the very best you can. You always try to keep the reader or the listener in mind and keep asking yourself, are they still with me? Is this still funny or heartfelt or interesting? But you have to also finish it and just get on to the next one. And so it's been good for me in the sense that I can't obsess over perfection. You just have to try and tell the story and then start telling another one. So,
but you also write, actually, one of the essays in this book is about being overcommitted to stuff.
And that's
just one more thing that's keeping you from, I don't know, re-caulking the bathroom.
Yes. And my wife and I have had a couple of family meetings about that this year. Collegial and all. But you do have to constantly decide. And in my case, I've gotten in the habit because I've been freelance for over 20 years now. You just never know where your next gig's coming from. Even now, I have a certain amount of uncertainty built into what I do. And so you do get in the habit of never turning down anything and just always working with one eye on the 6 months out. And at this point, I am fortunate enough that I have several opportunities. And you do have to start cutting a few things out here and there. And for me, that's been trying to find a little more time to arrange just solid blocks of extended writing time. I still write every day, but I'm looking for, can I put in 3 weeks without going on the road?
You've written a lot, and we've talked before about your relatively late entry into the world of more popular music.
Yes.
how you really didn't hear much when you were young, and then there's this Waylon Jennings story. So today, in the course of doing this radio show and your work as a musician yourself, you get to rub shoulders with more than a few musicians of renown. How do you see your kids growing up with all this music around them?
It's one of those situations where you want to expose them to things but not shove anything at them. And the example I've been using lately is I was privileged this past year to be allowed to write the liner notes for the new Blind Boys of Alabama album. And part of that came about because they recorded the album in all, of all places, Falkirk, Wisconsin, rural Falkirk, Wisconsin, quite literally a couple of cornfields away from our farm. And over the years, I've known and worked with a guy named Justin Vernon, who went on to, he had a little band called Bon Iver, won a couple of Grammys, used to be in my band. He'll come crawling back someday, I'm pretty sure. But he, as a result of some of his successes, has been able to build a pretty nice studio out there in the country. And so the Blind Boys came to record there. And it was a cold winter night, and I was able to take my then 12-year-old daughter with me. And we just watched a recording session, and she was able to watch an octogenarian gospel singer from the Deep South singing gospel music in real time, 20 feet away. And she was so moved on the way home, she just said, I'll remember this night for my whole life. And those are the things. I don't expect her to go buy everything that the Blind Boys have recorded. I don't expect her to become an expert on gospel music. But I just hope that, you know, she'll be back checking out Miley and listening to dubstep and explaining dubstep to her father, which she tried to do the other day. But it will be informed by what she saw. I think it's like so many things in life as a parent. You never know if you're doing the right thing, but you do try to expose them to these things, from singer-songwriters to pop to dance, whatever. And then, of course, I play a little guitar, which is really lame. I play guitar with all the nuance of a man cutting brush.
Well, but I wonder if, given your contribution to the Blind Boys of Alabama, their latest CD, I wonder if there's something to the idea that maybe your daughter grows up to be the kind of person that reads the liner notes.
Well, that would be nice. She ought to, because they're paying for her braces. So yeah, I hope so. Who knows, of course, what liner notes will be in that time. But you do speak to the idea of curiosity. And I think curiosity and, you know, I heard Neil Gaiman say something great one day about kids should be bored. And I agree with him, because he talked about how when he was a child, all his most creative thinking came from when he was bored stiff, because you were forced to come up with something. And nowadays, we just so desperately afraid of anybody not being completely occupied at all times, and kids especially. And so our poor kids, they get bored sometimes, and they'll say, I'm bored. And we go, oh, that's good. You better figure out something. And it is not necessarily digital. So I hope that she'll just have that curiosity and go looking for things like that, sure. And I think also to see – I love to take her to see shows and see recording. Not so she can watch the artist, but so she can watch, look, there's a girl over there who makes her living traveling around the world doing electronics. There's a stagehand up at Big Top Chautauqua. There, you know, the woman who runs the stage, you're watching a professional, a strong woman who makes sure that we're all where we need to be. And so to come to understand the idea that entertainment is not always about the person in the spotlight, but that there are just so many ways to find your way in this world.
But in this collection, you also write that you wouldn't mind if your kids learn to play guitar.
Yeah, because I think, and I can't quote myself exactly, but I've known some women who can play guitar. And generally, women who can play guitar don't take much off you. And I said, they don't put up with stuff. And if guy doesn't treat them right, they don't put up with it. And I also say that when they are mistreated by some guy, they write a song about him and they run him out of town in perpetuity.
Let me ask maybe an indelicate question here. I feel like you've written before about the many things you have read in, and we'll be blunt here, bathrooms.
Yes.
I feel like on some previous edition of the show,
yes,
you quoted the side of a toothpaste.
What it says on the back of the toothpaste right. tube, sure.
Is there some readerly karma in the fact that you have this book that might be fitting just that bill for some people?
I'm happy, man. I've done a lot of reading there. I'd be happy if you did. I don't have any problem talking about it. This is a collection of short pieces. And when I say short, 600 to 800 words is real short. seems to me to be perfectly suited for that sort of reading. I did see someone just tweeted a picture of the book up in their deer stand. And, you know, you, in between checking for deer, you maybe can read a quick little essay. So, no, I have no problem with that. I'm just happy to have anybody read me anywhere at any time.
I remember what a revelation it was to find out what that hole was for in the corner of the Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah.
The idea that it would be hung up in a place like a—
That's right. It's for the hook. And I'm looking here. I'm just quick checking in the margins here. You could quite easily take this book out to the drill press and sink a hole through it for that hook in the bathroom or the outhouse and not destroy any of the text. So I would— Matter of fact, maybe in future we'll start doing that for my book.
We're having this conversation as people are getting into the holiday season. It's we're talking in fairly early December. Do you have your Christmas tree yet?
I do not, but it's on the list. I'll be doing it either— Well, it won't be tonight because it's going to be dark by the time I get home. But we'll do it sometime this week because we always try to do it right after Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Yeah. We should. I guess we'll quickly transition into one of the essays here because it's interesting to think as someone who grew up in rural Wisconsin where trees were plentiful. You were not always a Christmas tree guy.
I was not. And there's a piece in the book, this new book From the Top, and it's called Christmas Tree Kids, and it's about my transition from never having a Christmas tree to now. Looking forward to going out this week and cutting one. Whatever the month, we already have our Christmas tree. It's back behind the pole barn. That's where they all are. I was never a Christmas tree guy. In part, this was due to the counterintuitive fact that I was raised in an obscure Christian church so fundamental, the December holiday was viewed as dangerously contrived pagan silliness. So when I was growing up, we never had a Christmas tree in the house. We did get Christmas because my grandma was a believer of a different stripe. She always bought a squat Scotch pine, and some years the pile of presents dwarfed the tree. Later, I left the church and was freed up to get a tree, but by then I was a bachelor and never had reason or interest in dressing or decorating my digs holiday-wise. You know, you got some deer horns and a concert poster on the wall, why mess with the vibe? Plus, based on my housekeeping history, last year's Christmas tree skeleton would still be standing. Also, once, after Grandpa died, I helped Grandma put up her annual Scotch pine, and the whole deal kind of cured me of Christmas trees in general. She had one of those plastic stands with the three screws, and every time I got the tree halfway vertical and tightened one of the screws, the tree would tip over. And just the same as smoke from a campfire always seems to swing around and blow in your face, no matter which screw I was tightening, no matter from what angle, that tree always seemed to manage to fall my way. The needles on a Scotch pine take the term needles very seriously, and by the time I got that blankety-blank tree to stand upright, I felt like I'd been loofed with an overactive porcupine. Oh, and the language, profoundly un-Christmassy. Anyways, for years, I didn't have a Christmas tree. Then I got married, and my wife brought with her a beautiful young girl named Amy, who's now my daughter. To my eternal shame, when our first Christmas rolled around, I still held out. We did decorate the house, but I didn't think we needed a tree. Plus, we were going to visit Grandma. But then we moved to a farm, and there were Christmas trees growing right out back. So the second week of December, we went ahead and cut one. I was reluctant, but Amy's eyes lit right up. She helped me saw it down, drag it in, and put it up. And now come the day after Thanksgiving, I'm the first one lobbying to grab the saw and get out there. We cut last year's tree out on the ridge, Amy taking her turn on the bucksaw, while Jane, our youngest, played in the snow with our black cat. We hauled the tree and the little one back home in a sled. Halfway down the trail, I took a picture of Annalisa and the girls and the tree. In the photo, all three of them are looking at me with blue eyes and smiles, the tree settled on the sled between them. We brought the tree inside and spent the evening stringing popcorn beside the fire and letting the girls take turns hanging ornaments. Later, when Annalisa was putting Jane to bed, I was in the kitchen doing dishes when I noticed the living room lights go out. I looked, and there was Amy sitting sideways in the old overstuffed chair, legs dangling, staring at the lit tree in the dark. You want, in moments like these, to just shut the world down and call it a day. And when I pulled that dishwater drain, that's exactly what I did. Went in and sat with her. That tree was a spruce, short and a tad gappy, although nowhere near Charlie Brown status. But it looked perfectly beautiful glowing in the corner that evening. I got to thinking about how long I'd held out against getting a Christmas tree and how the kids coming along changed things and what lesson I might take from that. And I believe those first Christmas trees taught me that sometimes you need to stop being the man you think you are and start being the man you ought to be. Merry Christmas.
Michael Perry reading his essay, Christmas Tree Kids, from his new collection, From the Top. Well, we are glad, as always, to have you here and come back and see us again. Mike Perry, thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Michael Perry's latest book is called From the Top, Brief Transmissions from Tent Show Radio, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. He lives in rural western Wisconsin and stopped by after a recent reading at the Fireman's Hall in Ixonia. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, why doctors should pay more attention to sepsis. And we'll learn about the little-known Milwaukeean who gave rise to a baseball tradition, souvenirs, and novelties. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.